It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we talk about Governor Evers' veto this week of a bill that would have reduced the amount of training required for certified nursing assistants. First, Thanksgiving is less than a week away, so a lot of us are stocking up and preparing to host a meal for family and or friends. That can always be challenging, but for anyone hosting for the first time, it can be extra intimidating. Not only is there plenty of cooking to worry about, but carrying on family traditions or starting new ones can make it an emotional time, too. Got us wondering, what's the best way to pull it off? That's where you come in at 800-642-1234. We want to know, what's your best advice to someone who's hosting their first Thanksgiving dinner? What do you remember about your first time doing it? What went well? What might have gone wrong? Were certain family dishes or traditions that stayed constant over the years, no matter who's hosting? Do you remember maybe doing it for the first time after it was passed down from one generation to the next? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson is with me in the studio. Hey, Judith.
Hey.
So this can be a big production, the Thanksgiving dinner.
It can, and I think the key word that you said was intimidating, mm-hmm. especially if you've never, I mean, it's not just that it's Thanksgiving, it's that it's usually more people than you're used to and more dishes than you're used to and timing things out. So yeah, I think it can be pretty intimidating.
Now, we've got some advice from listeners and our colleagues. People have posted on the Ideas Network Facebook page, and we'll wait for people's calls, of course, at 800-642-1234. I have some thoughts. So, like, making a whole turkey, it's kind of a big deal.
Yes.
It is something that can go wrong catastrophically, or just kind of, you know, you can end up with dry turkey.
Mm-hmm. Or
for
raw.
For smaller, yeah, that too. For smaller gatherings, I've just done turkey breast.
Yeah.
Just, you know, a packaged turkey breast, and that's a lot easier to be sure, because, like, you're going to do this big complicated thing, and the first time you do it, maybe, is under the clock with a big crowd waiting
right.
for it.
And also, if you know the people who are coming that are going to be enjoying the meal, if they're probably all going to be going for that white meat anyway, mm-hmm. I mean, there's often one or two people who, you know, will go for the drumstick. But, you know, especially the first time out, yeah, make it simple.
I have been to multiple Thanksgivings where exactly one person wanted to eat the drumstick. That person was Rob Ferret, public radio host. You know, and it's not like I love him so much. It's like, I'm happy to eat them, especially when no one else will. Most people, you're right, aren't going to miss that drumstick. So just that keeping it simple advice with maybe turkey breast. Now, we heard Tracy on Facebook wrote, she does the turkey. She says, I don't cook the turkey in the oven. A few years ago, I brought a large countertop roaster. Works great and frees up my oven for other things.
Yeah.
That's another good point, too,
the
oven traffic jam.
Well, and I'll say, too, when you're looking at what you're going to make, first of all, it's kind of like packing, you know. Think about everything you might possibly want to take on a vacation and then cut it in half. Same thing with the Thanksgiving dinner. Think of the things that you'd like to make and probably, you know, cut at least a few out and prioritize maybe some that you can do on top of the stove. So instead of, you know, I'm sure we'll get hate mail. Maybe you don't need to make the green bean casserole. Maybe you can do sautéed green beans. I know. It's, you know, of all the things we talk about, this is probably one of the more controversial. You know, but think about ways that you can do some of the stuff on the stovetop, maybe even a toaster oven, not just in the oven itself.
Well, the same Tracy who had that advice on the turkey says, crock pot mashed potatoes. Then you're not cooking and mashing potatoes right before the meal is ready. Saves chaos, saves mess. And again, that saves a burner or oven space, depending on what kind of potatoes you're going to make. Well, let's bring out a caller at 800-642-1234 with your advice for the first time Thanksgiving Day host. Elizabeth starts us off in Nina. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi there.
What do you got for us, Elizabeth?
Well, I have a tip, but it's not an actual like recipe tip.
Sure.
It's actually a people management tip. everyone will end up in the kitchen anyway. So think ahead of time what kind of tasks you can assign, because everyone will say, what can I do to help? And if you have some things in mind, it makes it a lot easier.
Interesting. And people, you've done this, Elizabeth, and it works?
I have. Not just for Thanksgiving.
So if you invite me over to your house for dinner, Elizabeth, I better come ready to work, it sounds like.
Well, or at least to socialize while others are working.
All right. I can do that, I guess. Elizabeth, thank you so much. Elizabeth, not alone on that one.
Right. And what I'll say is that as someone who was often the invitee, not the host for the dinner, you know, sometimes people have a recipe that's really meaningful to them. And so if you actually let them bring that, it means a lot to them to be able not just to contribute to the meal, but to be able to contribute something that's special. So one of the things that I learned that I did not learn early enough, but I learned now, is don't be afraid to ask for help. Don't be afraid to ask people to bring something.
Yeah, as Susanna Michaels from our membership team says, involve others in the cooking. She's on the same page. It's fun to sit around a table and chop vegetables. Don't feel like you need to cook every possible dish. Keep it simple. So yeah, enlist the people who say, what can I do to help to mm-hmm. be your prep cook, if nothing else?
And I'll also say, and this was a hard one for me to get past, don't feel like you have to do everything from scratch. So for instance, say you're making a cornbread stuffing, which is one of my favorites. You know, great. If you have the time to make a wonderful from scratch cornbread, that's great. But you know what? You can buy ready-made cornbread at the grocery store. All you have to do is crumble it up. One tip that we've talked about, actually, Rob, on other shows that I've really taken to heart is maybe you don't have time to do all that chopping. Salad bars have a lot of the stuff chopped
up already.
Just a
little stuff, yeah.
You know, some carrots, some celery, some whatever. You don't have to do it all yourself.
We are looking for your advice for the first-time Thanksgiving host. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll go back to your calls now. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi. Well, my first Thanksgiving after I was married, I invited my husband's family, and I insisted myself that I had to have all the special dishes. And by the time we sat down, I sat down and I broke down and cried.
Oh, no. You got through it, though.
I was so stressed out.
Oh, no.
And if I had to do it again, I would, as other people said, invite people to bring something, not insist on having the perfect Thanksgiving dinner, but just having a good time with my friends and family. And that's what I would do differently.
Okay, thank you so much for sharing that story. And yeah, I'd love to hear from people about what went wrong, too, maybe with their first or subsequent Thanksgivings.
Well, and our colleague Valerie Wasik from PBS Wisconsin said, my first time I didn't wash the turkey or remove the neck and giblets. Uh-oh. And every time I basted the turkey, I added another stick of butter. She said, paper started falling out of the turkey as I carved it, and the meal was gravyless. I was 22 years old, and I will add, the first time that I took over doing Thanksgiving dinner, I was actually 16 years old, and I never cooked a turkey.
Wow.
And to be honest, Thanksgiving hadn't been a huge holiday in our family, so I hadn't even gotten to watch a lot, but I felt really strongly about doing it, and I didn't know. Valerie was actually lucky that it was wrapped in paper. Mine were in plastic.
Plastic, oh no.
And yeah, the turkey had started cooking, and our wonderful across-the-street neighbor knew that I was doing this and actually called and said, just checking, you do know there's a plastic bag inside, right? I'm like, ah! So it was early enough that I could get it out. But yeah, there are things like that that can go wrong, might go wrong, and we'll still live to tell about it.
And Valerie had a part two to her story the next year. She says her family distracted her, switched the roasters, and Valerie was shocked when she found her turkey had shrunk to the size of a Cornish hen.
That's
for the past
elaborate.
30 years, she says, I've been plotting my revenge.
That's pretty it. Elaborate. I like that.
That takes some malice aforethought. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Wes is with us in Green Bay. Wes, hello.
Hi. I have found that a really good killer dessert, especially one that you can make ahead of time, will be a dry turkey, mushy green beans, lumpy mashed potatoes, everything will be forgiven if the dessert is really good, especially one that you can use a lot of whipped cream on.
Nice.
And make it ahead of time. Don't stress over it. Have it sitting in the refrigerator waiting.
That's awesome. And whipped cream does cover all flaws in the dessert as well.
Yes.
Do you have a favorite pie or other dessert to put out there, Wes?
Oh, Grandma's cheesecake.
Nice.
Everybody
will go away happy with that. Thank you, Wes, for that call. We are looking for your advice for the first time Thanksgiving dinner host. You can share your stories, your successes, your space and time-saving tips or your Thanksgiving fiascos. Call 800-642-1234. What tips do you have making that first Thanksgiving dinner? What worked when it came to picking up old family traditions? Or did you go in a whole new direction? One year I just made turkey enchiladas. I went straight to the turkey enchiladas.
Wow.
It was great. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. Central Time on the Ideas Work is what you're listening to right now. It's this week's edition of Food Friday. I'm Rob Farah. Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in with me for Food Friday. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We're looking for advice for the first-time Thanksgiving dinner host. What went right for you on your first ever Thanksgiving dinner? What went wrong? What do you wish you knew then that you know now? Call 800-642-1234. We got lots of callers. Let's go to Becca in Elk Mound. Becca, hi.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I've got a tip and a fiasco. So my fiasco was last year we had our first Friendsgiving. We drove out to North Dakota to one of my best girlfriend's houses, and we ended up with four mac and cheeses because our sorority sisters came together and nobody knew what anybody else was bringing. It wasn't too much of a problem, but it was pretty funny. And then the second one was that while we were there, we used our technology to help us with timing things out. My friend had an Alexa show, and so we had different timers, and we were able to see which thing needed to go in the oven next, and it was just fantastic. So that was really fun.
Becca, thank you so much for the story of carb loading. And, you know, we call it back timing in radio, and I think that's one of the most challenging things about cooking multiple dishes that you want ready and warm all at the same time.
Reverse timelines. It's, it's like planning a big event. And one of the things that can be hard to remember to do, if you are doing that turkey, if you want to baste it, you know, it's like, oh, it's a time again. And Sarah on Facebook said her grandmother passed down the not so secret to perfectly roasted birds, bacon.
Nice.
Always,
she just let it slowly drip over time.
Yeah, so a pound of bacon, lay the strips over the bird. She said you don't have to weave them in any fancy way. and you won't need to do anything under the skin of the bird or baste the turkey at all. So you also get the smell of bacon. And she said when the bacon's cooked crispy, take the turkey out of the oven, peel the bacon off, and it's a good appetizer. She specifies for the cook.
Nice.
Which I love too. And I'll say one technique that I've done is, it's not as fun or tasty as bacon, but actually cheesecloth over the turkey. And when you baste it, it actually holds it on there instead of the butter or whatever just rolling right off.
But don't eat the cheesecloth.
Don't eat the cheesecloth.
Courtney Everett from The Morning Show, a producer for The Morning Show, said use warmers for the food. It feels like everything's done before the turkey is, and so it ends up getting cold. So that's a nice, even if everything's not ready at the same time. Back to your calls now. Carol is with us in De Pere. Carol, hi.
Hi there. So I have a tip for a first-time person that's very organized and OCD about preparing a big meal. I was very anxious to impress my family and my mother-in-law that I could handle this big meal. And so I figured I could boil my potatoes ahead of time for my, mashed potatoes. And so I did that. I boiled them and put them in the fridge thinking I'll pull them out, prior to the meal and mash them up. Little did I know that when you boil potatoes and then they cool, they become glue. And so it was like a huge wad of bubble gum in the pan. And it had to be thrown out. So my advice would be, don't prepare too much ahead of time, and especially not potatoes.
Okay, now what you do there, they're blue, you put in some beet dye or red food coloring, and then something white, I don't know, like mayonnaise or something. You got red, white, and blue. You got
she
American potatoes.
Glue.
Oh, glue. I just said blue.
I think she said...
No, blue.
Glue.
Oh, glue.
They turn, yeah, they
glue.
Don't turn blue.
Okay, I thought she was saying they turned bluish. That would be weird.
That was very patriotic of you, Rob.
And then you use them as an adhesive. Okay, I got nothing. Thank you so much for sharing that. Yeah, potatoes do get weird when you pre-cook them like that. Though I don't know. Yeah.
There's some things that freeze really well, like wild rice freezes really well. So
I've never made wild rice for Thanksgiving. That's a great idea.
It's a very good idea. Thank you.
I'm not knocking it. Back to the callers now. AJ is with us in Green Bay. AJ, hello.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Good.
For me, the best way to cook a turkey is when you bring it out of the roaster, chip all the meat off the bird and make a homemade gravy with the drippings and stuff, and then reheat that. Because most of all the time.
All right, so make that gravy out of the turkey and then get the gravy back on the turkey.
That sounds awesome.
That sounds like a great idea.
Again, I have to say gravy, it sounds silly, but gravy intimidates me. I've never actually made homemade gravy.
I have, you know, I'm not great at it. Yeah. I'm not great at it. Yeah. But, it, I mean, when people pull it off, it's really good. Let's go to Carol now in New Richmond. Carol, hi.
Hi there. Yeah, just some advice for pretty much everyone. If you, my mom once, she used to like have a really bad habit of chewing on her fingers, and so it would be common to see her wear a Band-Aid. Well, she made the turkey, and one of the Band-Aids slipped off.
Oh, no.
And went into the stuffing. Yep. So if you have any Band-Aids, you probably should remove them.
There you go.
Yeah, if my sisters are or brothers listening across the state, they'll be laughing right now.
Wow.
But yeah.
Okay, Carol, I got to ask, is this one that you made fun of your mom of for years, or did everybody pipe down about this one for years?
Oh, no. We brought it up, and we made fun of her. And, yeah, she thought it was funny, too. But, you know, I mean, it was all in good fun. I mean, she didn't mean it, but, yeah, pretty disgusting.
Carol,
so.
Thanks.
That's great. And I will say some of those family traditions are bringing up the things that go wrong in previous years. Stephanie Elkins, one of our wonderful music hosts, said, my first gathering, I followed a recipe for a historical drink called cranberry shrub that involved copious quantities of vinegar. And shrubs are really popular now. So others might be trying this. She said, it was awful and became a family joke for years afterwards, but it did get everyone laughing, including me.
Yum. Vinegary cranberry. I mean, I can't see what could have gone wrong there. Still time for you to share your advice for the first-time Thanksgiving host at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Daniel is with us in Minocqua. Daniel, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What do you got for us, Daniel?
It seems like a lot of people want a deep-fried turkey these days, and I just got a couple tips to go along with that that'll help kind of smooth out an awful, intimidating process. First tip is always defrost your turkey.
Good.
Don't burn down your yard.
Oh, yeah.
You got to get it all the way defrosted. My second tip, and this comes from a coworker, measure out the amount of oil beforehand so that you don't end up frying only half your turkey and having to flip it upside down to go ahead and fry the other half.
All right. Have you pulled this off successfully, Daniel?
I have pulled it off successfully for years, and my mother-in-law wants me to do one this year, so the ante has been upped a lot.
Well, I have to say, Daniel, when you said you had some advice for deep-frying turkeys, I thought you were going to say, just don't. Because it seems
No, it makes the most delicious turkey you've ever had.
Wow. Well, I would have to get past the fear of it.
But. Yeah. Well, as long as Daniel's doing I'm all for it.
Yeah. Daniel, just send us an email with where we should be and when. We'll be there.
Alrighty, guys. Sounds good.
Thanks for the call, Daniel. We heard from some sentimental stories from our colleagues. Bram Sable-Smith, investigative reporting fellow, says he's hosting Thanksgiving for the first time. It's a strange feeling. Bram says this will mark the end of an eventful year where I bought my first house and got married. Congratulations, Bram. Somehow hosting my family for Thanksgiving is what feels like a turning point in my life where I've pivoted from being a son and younger brother to being a grown man, taking on the responsibility of cultivating my family and traditions. Yeah, it is a big adulting moment, as you say these days.
And I think that also adds sometimes to the anxiety and the stresses. You want it to be perfect. And you know what? What I've learned, Rob, is that the people around you, the people that you are hosting, they are a friendly audience 99%
hopefully
of the time. Yeah. But, you know,
not.
They appreciate that you're doing it. And so they're going to cut you more slack than you're cutting yourself.
I think that is fair. That is fair. Back to your calls. Time for a couple or even a couple few more calls. KC is with us in Waukesha. KC, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, KC?
Well, I was hosting my first Thanksgiving dinner, and I was scared to make mashed potatoes. And I had asked if my mother-in-law could bring them because she made absolutely the best mashed potatoes. When she walked into the door, she handed me a 5-pound bag of raw potatoes.
Oh, no.
If that ever happens, just say thank you and try your best.
So did you end up pulling off mashed potatoes from the time she got in the door till you put it on the table?
Well, they weren't the
best, but I have since then perfected it. But yeah, they weren't the best. No,
okay.
Not at all.
Well, really, she only had herself to blame, the mother-in-law.
Well, I mean, you got to be clear. Can you bring the potatoes? Like, if you ask that way, you don't know what you're going to get.
It's a very, raw potatoes. Very literally, yes.
Thanks, KC. I'll go now to Lisa in La Crosse. Lisa, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share, I was a residence hall dorm director for 10 years at a few different institutions, and one of my favorite memories was around Thanksgiving time, I would order a turducken from campus catering, of course, the hen inside of a duck inside of a turkey, and then ask the students in the residence hall to bring whatever they had in their room. So usually we had turducken with Doritos and ramen and canned peas, and it was a lot of fun.
Pop-Tarts for dessert.
Right, exactly.
That's
exactly.
Awesome.
Now, this turducken's pre-cooked, right? You're not trying to do it on a hot plate in the dorm room, right?
Right. No. Hot plates aren't allowed. It would have to be.
Oh, right.
That's awesome.
Yeah, because nobody had hot plates on your floors. Wink. Lisa, thank you
so
much.
Wow.
So
now
great.
I want to start adding ramen into the Thanksgiving tradition.
That I bet you could pull off.
Yeah.
And Pop-Tarts.
Yes.
It's time for another caller or two. Joanne is with us in Eagle. Joanne, hi.
Hi. My idea is something that I finally found out a few years ago, and it works wonderfully. There's such a hassle getting all your food on the table at the last minute. I found out that you make two turkeys, smallish ones.
Ooh.
You roast one ahead of time, slice it, make the gravy, it's all done. The second one you roast on the day of Thanksgiving, and you take it out of the oven, and you put it on the table, and it looks beautiful. And you've already got everything else ready.
Very
and you get
nice.
Your food out without going through it.
A little subterfuge.
I was
going to
say
Joanne.
A little sleight of hand there. Look how beautiful it is. Oh, look, it's already carved.
And then we've got Jim in Reedsburg. Jim, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What's your tip, Jim?
Well, it wasn't me, but our Thanksgiving consisted of everybody bringing a dish to pass. My cousin designed a Weber grill to roast a turkey on. He able to feed the charcoal through the side, and there was a drip pan.
Ooh.
But he would put thick-cut bacon over the top of it. And as the bacon got done, he would replace it with another piece. So by the time this roasted Weber roasted turkey was done, you could melt it with your eyes.
Nice. That's fantastic, Jim. Another great bacon tip to leave us with. Hey, you can keep sharing your Thanksgiving meal first-timer tips at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Thanks for your calls. And Judith, thanks for sitting in.
Always fun.
120 hours is the amount of training currently required for certified nursing assistants in Wisconsin. Some lawmakers proposed legislation at the state level that would have lowered that number to 75 hours. Earlier this week, Governor Tony Evers vetoed that bill. Some supporters of the idea said it would have helped with a staffing shortage at nursing homes in Wisconsin. Sarah Endicott is a clinical associate professor with UW-Madison School of Nursing. She also has a clinical practice in skilled nursing facilities in rural Wisconsin. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get into the details of how much training goes into being a CNA, a certified nursing assistant, can you talk about the role they play in our health care here in Wisconsin?
CNAs are absolutely crucial. They're on the front lines of care, especially in long-term care facilities. The majority of CNAs do work in nursing homes and assisted living facilities, and they're really taking care of the most vulnerable patients in our communities. So they're doing physical cares, they're helping with mobility, and they are probably the first ones who are going to notice if there's an emerging health problem with an older adult.
And what is it like being a CNA here in Wisconsin as far as things like pay and working conditions?
Well, I think those probably vary across settings, but overall, it's a very challenging role. The pay is not very high. I think the average is about $26,000 a year, and that's for really the entry level to healthcare professions. So we're asking CNAs to do a lot with a very vulnerable population for not a lot of pay. They're also having to learn complex skills and do some pretty physical labor for that pay.
We've heard over the years that we have a shortage of CNAs, at least in some settings in Wisconsin. Do you see that from where you're standing?
Absolutely. It's not only that we have a lot of vacancies, but we have a big turnover rate. So people come into the field, they're interested in healthcare and helping others, but then they run into challenges once they're working in those settings, and they leave, and not necessarily for higher paying jobs, but because they don't feel like they have in some cases, the training and the education they need to provide the kind of care that they want to give.
Can you talk about the kind of training and the amount of training that's currently required for that incoming CNA?
Sure. In Wisconsin now, CNAs need 120 hours of training, and that includes 32 hours of clinical experience. So it covers a broad range of topics, but even with that 120 hours, you can't go into that much depth with the different topics, such as how to work with people living with dementia. So although 120 hours sounds like a lot compared to 75, it's still not a lot of training considering the complexity of care that we're asking CNAs to provide.
Right. This plan that passed the legislature but was vetoed by the governor cut that 120 down to 75 hours. Now, supporters of this say, well, hold on, Wisconsin has a higher standard here than some of our neighboring states, than federal standards. If they're getting by with that lower amount of training, why can't we?
Well, I think it's arguable that they're getting by with that lower standard of training. So I think it has been problematic in some of our surrounding states, and I don't think we should use a lower standard as our standard in Wisconsin, because we provide really good care for the most part with not a lot of resources. For many years, Wisconsin's been among the states with the lowest Medicaid reimbursement rate for nursing homes. So we're asking nursing home administrators and staff to do a lot with very little. So I think Governor Evers recently committed to increasing that amount of money quite a bit, which is a step in the right direction. But so I don't think the answer is necessarily cutting training, instead looking at other ways that we can retain CNAs and really get to the root cause of why we have those vacancies.
Talking to Sarah Endicott with UW-Madison School of Nursing, talking about certified nursing assistants. A plan in the state legislature would have cut the number of hours they need to be trained before going into the field. Governor Evers vetoed that. If you are a CNA or if you're someone who hires them or counts on them, love to hear your story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And the training that goes into the job. Let's bring on a caller now. Dan is with us in Wisconsin Dells. Dan, hello.
Hello there. I used to be an activity director at a nursing home in the Dells area. And I always felt that the CNAs, they worked the hardest. They didn't get the credit that they deserved. And really, they were the heart of the whole facility. They were the one-on-one with the residents. And I just cannot see enough about CNAs, how hard they work, and just don't get enough credit.
Dan, thanks for the call. Sarah?
I couldn't agree with Dan more. I've worked in long-term care facilities for almost a decade, and when I go in to see my patients, the first person I'm going to turn to is the CNA, because they know that patient best. We have wonderful, skilled, educated nurses, but they heavily rely on the report. They're really the eyes and ears for the nurses, because they're the ones who are doing all the interaction with patients and also their families.
You mentioned, thanks for that call, Dan. You mentioned turnover, Sarah. And is more training maybe something that's going to help prevent that turnover if they know what they're in for, I guess, and getting into and doing that clinical work beforehand? Is that going to help maybe help people stay on that job longer?
That's what the evidence shows, actually. We have seen in research studies, really large-scale studies, that show that when CNAs get education that goes above the federal minimum of 75 hours, they actually report greater job satisfaction and feel like the quality of the education they received is higher than those CNAs who got just the minimum 75 hours.
And you mentioned CNAs as kind of the early detection system for a change in health condition, an early warning of a condition. Apart from the actual tasks the CNA does, how much training do they get in spotting those warning signs of, I don't know what, diabetes, dementia, you name it?
And that's kind of variable, and that's one of the things that I think if we're going to talk about how we can retain CNAs, maybe we don't look at the number of hours that are required, but again, the quality of the actual clinical application of those skills. So, for example, if you have somebody who has dementia and they can't communicate the way that you or I might if we're not feeling well, maybe the sign that they have pneumonia or some other serious problem is just that they're eating less or they're showing different behaviors than they have previously. And the person who's most likely to see that is the person who's helping them get dressed, the person who's helping to feed them or working with them on a day-to-day basis.
Let's bring on another caller now. Howard is with us in Milwaukee. Howard, hello.
Hello. You know, we're acting as though this is a giant mystery is why there's a shortage of CNAs. For our listeners that are listening, it's very simple. Pay should be commensurate with responsibility, except in this case. Here we have people taking care of people that we love, and they're paid terrible, and it is a back-breaking work and emotionally draining. They have a workplace injury rate on par with farm workers and coal miners. And quite frankly, it's not a mystery as to why there's a shortage. The pay needs to come up, conditions need to come up, and respect has to come up for the CNAs. Because for the people that are listening, it's not the RNs that take care of our elders. It's the CNAs that are on the front line. And I'll take your comments off the air. Thank you.
Howard, thanks for the call. Sarah?
I have to agree with Howard and what he said. And he's obviously passionate about it, and I really appreciate that. We don't highly value the people who do this work in our communities, even in the healthcare setting. Even though CNAs are crucial, they don't get a lot of respect. They don't get a lot of recognition. They don't always have even the role within a nursing facility or other healthcare facilities where they can have a voice for the patient. So if you don't feel like what you do is valued, or you don't feel like you have the training that you need to be able to, or the resources to provide the kind of care that you think someone deserves, then that's going to lead to low job satisfaction.
Lots of people calling in on this. Christine joins us now in Walworth. Christine, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Christine?
I'm an RN. I work in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and have worked there for many years. I have a lifelong career in the healthcare field. Nursing assistants are irreplaceable, and it's a crying shame that they're paying them more to start at Amazon and places like Target, for heaven's sakes, where they have better benefits and better pay. I really fault the corporations, one in particular that I work for, that they don't give them a living wage, you know, and many of the CNAs historically throughout my career are single parents, and for a single parent, and they're barely above poverty level, so they can't get any state aid, you know. It's just a crying shame.
Christine, thanks for the call. She's saying an employer of CNAs might be competing with retail, Target, Amazon, around comparable pay wages.
Yeah, I think actually, in fact, people in those other organizations, especially with our low unemployment rates, are making more, but for jobs that are arguably less satisfying and less important to us in communities. So I agree that the way that you show value for those positions is by paying people more, training them more, giving them a safe environment, giving them higher status in our communities, and that's what's going to lead to retaining CNAs and also attracting people to the field who want to care for others.
Time for one more caller. Ben is with us in Eau Claire. Ben, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Ben?
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up the situation that my wife is in. We moved up here to Wisconsin from Iowa about 2 years ago. My wife was a licensed CNA down in Iowa, but since there is a difference in the amount of hours required up here in Wisconsin, she's been unable to work as a CNA up here. Furthermore, there's actually no program to bridge those hours. So there's nothing where she could just go from the 75 to 120 to get licensed. She'd have to go through that training entirely again, which we have a young kid now, and she's also in school to become a registered nurse, which makes it extremely difficult for us to go back through that training.
Ben, thanks a lot for that call. I've heard that concern that we can't just hire CNAs from neighboring states because they aren't qualified. What do you think of that idea of that bridge for people who are partway there and get those last 40-some hours?
I think that's an excellent idea, and I think the truth is that what was proposed to cut hours is one kind of short-sighted solution, and there are a range of different ideas that we could take on to approach this issue.
In our last minute or so, Sarah, thanks for that call. Do you see, even if this wasn't the right answer, do you at least see people taking the problem seriously and looking for a solution, whatever it might be.
Well, this is not a problem that's going to go away. We're only going to have a greater and greater need for CNAs and those people at the front line. So I think, as we heard from a lot of the callers, this is a really important issue to people in Wisconsin.
And we'll need more as our more and more baby boomers, I imagine, hit that situation where they might need those CNAs.
Absolutely. They're a crucial part of the workforce and a crucial part of our community.
Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today in the studio.
Thanks for having me.
That's Sarah Endicott, Clinical Associate Professor with UW-Madison School of Nursing, where she's the Population Lead for the Adult Gerontology Primary Care DNP Cohort. We've been talking about the training that certified nursing assistants get here in Wisconsin. A plan in the legislature would have cut the number of hours back in required training. The governor vetoed that plan. Our guest says there are other possible solutions we should be looking at. If you have a story of working as a CNA or with CNAs, love to hear you share that with us. You can email ideas@WPR.org or share your thoughts on Twitter @CentralTimeWPR. Major utility companies serving the state have set goals to drastically reduce carbon emissions over the next several decades. Plans include increasing solar and wind projects. Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. She joined us to explain how they're making that transition to renewables. Danny, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, you write that some utilities around the state are bringing in renewable energy sources a little faster than expected. Before we get to specifics, what are some of the things driving the move toward renewable energy?
Well, right now, the transition is really being driven by declining costs for renewables, you know, customer and investor demand, and some anticipation of policy changes that might be coming down the line with carbon emissions.
What is this replacing at this point as renewable sources come online? What is going away? Or is it just adding to the existing stock, I guess?
Well, there's a lot happening with it. And I think the big focus from environmental groups and from citizens, you know, they've been pushing a lot for utilities to be more aggressive in transitioning away from coal-fired power plants. So a lot of what we're seeing right now is a mix of a variety of things, and it all depends on the utilities themselves and what they have in their existing energy mix and a lot of other factors. But, you know, we're seeing utilities like WEC Energy Group, which owns Wisconsin Public Service, and We Energies and Alliant Energy, you know, they've both been making transitions away from coal-fired generation to natural gas. And at the same time, they've been looking at adding renewable energy to their portfolio, including wind and solar. But it looks different for each utility. I mean, if you look at We Energies and Wisconsin Public Service and their parent company, you know, they have nuclear energy in the mix for what they provide. So does Xcel Energy, which is a Minneapolis-based utility that serves Wisconsin. And so it looks different with each utility you have, and I think that's part of the reason that you're seeing this difference in how fast each of them may be transitioning. And the level of investment they've made recently in coal-fired power plants, because if they've made investments in the last decade or so, they're probably still paying those off. And so it doesn't look as favorable for them or their customers to be, you know, transitioning away from coal-fired generation, and they would need to recover those costs while also investing in renewable forms of energy.
And I tend to think of a solar power, for example, as being a small thing. You know, somebody puts solar panels up on their rooftop. It looks like one of the things you write about is some of these utilities are doing bigger and bigger solar projects. Can you talk about what we're seeing out there?
Yeah, in the last couple of years, we've seen the first utility scale solar projects in Wisconsin. And the reason for that is that the cost of solar is really coming down and more economical for these utilities. And so we had Alliant Energy that announced plans earlier this month to add 1,000 megawatts of solar. You know, WEC Energy Group has received approval or is seeking 300 megawatts of solar. And they've also got wind in the mix, and so does Alliant. So that's why we're seeing some more of the solar generation plans being wrapped into these utilities now moving forward.
Sometimes we hear about targets. Sometimes it's from the state or environmental groups, you know, X percent of renewables by whatever year. Are the utility companies that you looked at operating by that mindset, we're trying to hit this benchmark for renewables by whatever decade?
Yeah, I think every utility would like to meet those goals that have been set forth under the Paris Climate Accord, or, you know, Governor Evers and his goal of 100% carbon-free electricity by 2050. You know, they're all moving towards that mark. It's just a question of how you get there. Xcel Energy was the first major utility in the nation to announce that they were going to go 100%, but they've admitted that they don't know how they're going to, you know, get to that last 20%. We Energies and Wisconsin Public Service and Alliant have all said that they're going to cut carbon emissions by 80%. And so a lot of it remains to be seen with, you know, the regulatory environment and policies or incentives that encourage them to make these changes, as well as the development of technology and, you know, what kind of options we have for transitioning away from fossil fuel plants.
Talking to WPR reporter Danielle Kading about the move toward renewable energy at many Wisconsin utility companies. And Danny, how about ratepayers, the people who pay for their electricity bill? Are there thoughts about how this might affect them for better or worse?
Yeah, and that really has to do with the coal-fired power plants. You know, like I said before, if they've made investments in new plants, or they have plants that are coming up on retirement, they're kind of weighing whether or not they should make more investments in these plants, or, you know, how much they have yet to pay off on these plants, because they would be able to recover those costs that they invested from ratepayers. And if they look to make that transition, it's more difficult, I think, for them to do that if they're going to be asking their ratepayers to pay twice, you know, pay for the investment they've already made on something that's no longer useful, or while they're moving to invest in cleaner forms of energy.
And Danny, something you've mentioned already, but, you know, Wisconsin's a coal-heavy state in its energy mix, but the story here isn't shutting down coal plants and replacing them with renewable energy right away. Natural gas, as you touched on earlier, is going to be at least a part of a transition, if not sticking around even longer, right?
Yeah, some utilities are using it as a bridge fuel. Xcel Energy has admitted to using it to help make this transition, because, you know, the big argument that utilities make is, well, we need to be able to provide that reliability and affordability of service when we have intermittent sources of power. So when the sun is not shining and the wind is not blowing, that's their common catchphrase, you know, that they need to be providing energy, and natural gas is one way to do that. But they've also have nuclear energy that they're providing, whether it's through power purchase agreements or they own that, to also provide energy for their customers.
And briefly, Danny, as we wrap up, you wrote about the question of renewable energy technology and whether it's it only works while the sun is shining, as you said, or the wind is blowing, or whether we can store it in some form of batteries. And it sounds like that's one of the question marks right now with existing technology.
Yeah, because the price of batteries right now has been likened to where solar was at a decade ago. So right now it may be that the cost for battery storage is not as economical at the present time. But energy analysts are saying, you know, it would be unwise to rule them out entirely. And even utilities say it's going to be an all of the above kind of solution to get to that 100% carbon-free electricity mix.
Danny, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That was Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior. She joined us for a look at the plans that large utility companies around Wisconsin have for reducing their carbon emissions. You can find her reporting on that and lots of other news from around Wisconsin. Just head over to WPR.org/news for coverage of politics, energy, the environment, and more all over Wisconsin. That's WPR.org/news. The 1982 movie Blade Runner painted a bleak but cool-looking vision of the future. But as of this week, it's a movie about the past. Why? As movie fans point out, the original Blade Runner movie has a title card that says it's set in November of 2019. and close watchers of the more recent sequel, set in 2049, saw information that sets the original movie this week. Specifically, the action takes place apparently from November 19th to November 22nd, 2019. Pop culture fans celebrated the milestone, and so did the Tesla company, revealing a futuristic Cybertruck to coincide with Blade Runner Day. The day came and went without flying cars and without synthetic humans walking among us, at least as far as we know. Online magazines have been pointing out other movie and TV futures that didn't come to pass. The TV show Space 1999 was set on a thriving moon base that's set adrift when the moon goes flying away. Terminator 2 was set in 1995 with an apocalypse set for 1997, though maybe Sarah Connor really did stop that one. Back to the Future 2 traveled forward in time to 2015 with hoverboards all around. We didn't quite get there. And Escape from New York had all of New York City turned into a high-security prison colony by the year 1997. Good luck getting those tickets to The Lion King. Celebrating days of future past, this is Central Time.